Why are vampires so easy to fool? Because they are suckers! Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 151. 151? Isn't that like a Bacardi or a rum or something? I don't know. I don't drink. I was trying to make an alcohol reference, but I think I failed. Anyways, I'm your host, Kaylin Chenoweth, and this is Starting Sustainability. Just like we do with every episode leading up to this point, we're going to catch up with Kaylin and see what's going on in my personal world before we get to the really good stuff, the main topic. Well, what has been going on? Let me see. My oldest, Corbin, who's 5 and in kindergarten, had fall break. This was his first school break, and this was my first school break as a parent. We had some pretty exciting plans. The plan was to have a Corbin and Mommy day all day long, just the two of us. We were going to go to Hobby Lobby, buy the supplies that we needed to make our costumes and do that and maybe make some cookies. But the daycare provider got sick and closed the daycare, so I had all 3 kids, and it was just me because Channing still had to work, only I took PTO. Instead, we just made a whole lot of messes and cleaned them up, so it was a bit stressful, but I handled it. We did all right. After the kids went to bed, then I started working on the Halloween costumes. Corbin, as a 5-year-old, could have helped me, yes, but because the other two were there, it made it a lot more stressful, and I just waited till everybody went to bed and started working on it. I mentioned already that Corbin wants to be a megalodon and Colt wants to be a whale shark. And I think Hazley's also going to be a shark because that's what I could find supplies for. I was able to find a cute little gray zip-up hoodie for Hazley that I could easily convert into a shark costume. Much easier than what I could find for anything else water-related, like a squid, a jellyfish, or mermaid. The other part of the costumes was Channing and I were going to go as scuba divers. That's still the plan. We're going to go as scuba divers. Okay, all we gotta do is wear all black pants, black shirt, and then get the 2-liter soda bottles and spray paint them black and make those our scuba tanks, strap them to our back. Cool, guess what? We don't drink pop or soda, whatever you want to call it, and I need 4 of these. So I started asking family and friends. Apparently, all of our family and friends are healthy, and they also do not drink soda in mass quantities. I do not know where to get 2-liter bottles from. I don't want to go to the store to buy them, to dump them out just for the bottle. That doesn't make any sense. The whole point of this is to be sustainable. I want to reuse some. I guess I could go to the recycling bin, but I think they would be sticky, possibly have some mold inside, and just gross, probably crushed as well. So I'd have to figure out how to reinflate them. For being a simple costume, it sure turned out to be harder than I thought it would be to put this together. That was day 1 of Corbin's break. Day 2, luckily it was only a 2-day break. Day 2, we went to the zoo. That was a lot of fun. I decided to bring Colt along because you can't bring one kid and not the other. And Hazley went to the daycare, which did reopen because she's in a stroller all day long. We'd have to navigate nap time and diaper changes and feeding her and keeping the formula in the bottle cold. And it sounds like it'd be fun to bring a baby to the zoo, but it's really not. Not when you've got 2 other kids. That's very overwhelming to do. So I just took the boys and we had fun. It was $10 to park, $25 for my ticket, $20 for Corbin's ticket, $20 for Colt's ticket. That was with a coupon that I had for $8 off per ticket. So we'd already saved $24. And the grand total was $75 at this point. Just to get into the zoo. This is why we don't go very often. Yes, I am aware that we could get an annual pass. That's like $300 and the zoo's over an hour away. And honestly, after being there all day, we're good. We're good for the next year. We don't really need to go back. We're just fine. I don't want an annual pass and feel like I have to go use it all the time. It's too much work and effort and stress. We did meet up with friends there. We all brought our lunches to help save money because it was already expensive enough. And one of the kids dropped their lunchbox and it fell through the fence into the giraffe exhibit. There were 2 fences. So the first fence was a wooden fence that had horizontal logs and spaces, easy to climb, to stand up on and look over to get a better look at the giraffe, which is great when you're a kid. But the problem was she was holding her lunchbox and then dropped it and it literally fell through the slats of the fence. Then there's about a good 6 feet before you get to a second fence, which is a big tall chain link fence, which is great. It meant that it was still safe if I wanted to climb over the fence and retrieve the lunchbox. It was out of arm's reach. We were actually going to have to climb over the fence to get it. But it really wasn't about the athleticism of climbing the fence. It was about getting kicked out if we got caught climbing that fence. And we'd already paid $75. We'd only been there for 30 minutes. So we went and found an employee who radioed somebody and met us at the giraffe exhibit. It took 3 employees. Finally, one of them just climbed over the fence, grabbed it, brought it back, and we all just said, thank you. After that, I got the carabiners off of my backpack, where all of our lunches were, and handed them to my friend's kids, and we clipped their lunch boxes to their belt loops. That way that wouldn't happen again. Tomorrow, Corbin is going on his first field trip, which is exciting. He's going to a pumpkin patch. And we, parents, were instructed to pack a completely disposable sack lunch for him. That is a challenge in our household because we have spent the last few years eliminating single-use items. We did struggle a bit trying to piece together a lunch for him. He's going to have to get a disposable water bottle from our emergency water supply. We don't really have Ziploc bags. Therefore, he's going to get a sandwich wrapped in Saran wrap because we've had the same roll for the last 5 years. We just don't use it. But there is enough left to wrap up a sandwich because I don't have a Ziploc bag to put it in. An apple, because you don't have to have anything to pack that in. And we have an old sour cream container, a little one, and that's probably going to hold baby carrots. And all of his lunch will be inside of a Walmart sack. It took us a while to figure out how to pack this because we're just not used to having to come up with disposable items. It's not that great of a story. It's just really ironic to me. It's like, wow, we've strived so hard to get away from this and now we have to figure out how to do it again. When I guess for a lot of people, it's pretty common and easy on how to pack a completely disposable lunch. Something else school related that I wanted to share. I don't remember if I shared this or not. So I'm going to bring it up and tell you again. It's a nice reminder. And if I haven't shared it, enjoy it for the first time. At the beginning of the school year, on the school supply list was a box of, they wanted one box of 50 gallon size Ziploc bags, a large box of this. We reluctantly bought them and dropped them off at the school as directed. And it turns out it was so the teacher could send home a new gallon-sized Ziploc bag every Friday for us parents to put snacks in for the week to send with the kid on Monday. We're required to send 5 snacks every Monday for the whole week. The note sent home to the parents encouraged us to buy large snack bags and boxes of items and then to use little snack Ziploc bags to help save money. So like buy one big item, buy it in bulk, that way you can divide it up yourself versus buying individually wrapped snacks. The whole purpose for this was to save money and be financially smart, I guess. To be honest, that did anger me, but I didn't say anything. This is Corbin's new school, new teacher. I don't want to ruffle feathers. And I had to remind myself that the teacher was just trying to be helpful, and I appreciate that. But there were 2 big issues with this. First, I don't really like the fact that we keep pumping our kids full of snacks every 10 minutes. This has been an issue all through daycare, preschool, and now kindergarten. The routine is feed them breakfast, then a morning snack, then lunch, then an afternoon snack, then a 5 p.m. snack while you're waiting on the parents to come pick them up. Then I take them home and I feed them dinner. But really what's happening is they eat breakfast, they eat morning snack, they don't touch their lunch, they eat the afternoon snacks, they don't touch their dinner. Of course the kid's gonna eat the snacks and not the meals. I mean, duh. Animal crackers taste way better than a fish sandwich. According to any kid, I'm sure. I did not grow up with snacks. We waited until mealtime, and then we ate the meal. Nobody starved to death in the 30 minutes that it took to prepare dinner. At Corbin's preschool, we were actually required to send 2 snacks every day, or we would be charged $3 by the preschool because they would have to provide a snack. Now, the second issue I have with this whole mess is that if I have to provide a snack, I do not have to do it in a wasteful way. So I did eventually email the teacher and explain that we have a focus on sustainability in our family, and I asked if we could provide a reusable bag to hold the snacks and to send the snacks in a reusable Tupperware. I also stated that if this was an issue, I would comply and go purchase these items because I didn't really want to upset anybody. I didn't want to make this hard on anyone. I just thought I would simply ask the question if we could do this. And she responded, "That's no problem at all." She was really in favor of being sustainable, which was wonderful and great. Now for the sack lunch for his field trip, I imagine they don't want to keep track of every kid's lunch boxes because some will get lost, left behind, mixed up with others. They are going to a pumpkin patch farm event, so we will comply. Although when I was a kid and we went on field trips, we all had assigned seats on the bus and ate lunches with our lunch boxes. And then we went and put the lunch boxes in our seats on the bus. I just took the win over the weekly snacks and I'm not going to push back on the field trip. This is just a one-time thing. It just does bother me enough to put it on the podcast, apparently. Okay, moving on, changing topics. Let's talk about chickens. We are trying to merge our chicken flocks together, and it's definitely a lot harder than we thought it would be. Oh, by the way, so a while ago, like over a month ago, I think, I posted it on the Starting Sustainability Facebook group, pictures of all of our little chickies. Now, the original chickens, their names are Creme Brulee, Frittata, and Gallo de Cielo. So Creme Brulee and Frittata are the egg layer hens, Gallo de Cielo is the rooster. Now, this new flock, here's the name Winners, because I didn't get back to anybody. The name Winners, we have a Sunny Side Up, call her Sunny. Souffle, but we call her Souffly Away because she's always flying away from you. She was the first one to start flying. Then we have Egg Beaters, who goes by Beaters, and we have Scrambled, like scrambled eggs. And then for the roosters, we have Zorro, who's the all-black rooster. Haystack, who is white and brown. My mom named him, and I was like, "Haystack, but I want an egg dish." She goes, "It is an egg dish. It's hash browns with eggs on top. They call it a haystack." And I said, "Oh, I did not know that." So, went with Haystack. I was like, "Yeah, he definitely looks like a pile of hash browns with eggs on top." So, he's Haystack. And then the last one, who's all white, 100% white rooster, his name is Benedict, because he just seems very official and formal. And I mean, Benedict for eggs Benedict is where it's coming from, but Benedict to me sounds, I guess, like Benedict Arnold. I don't know why. It sounds like a military type name, and he just seems like a military commander of some type. So thank you to everyone who participated and submitted names. They are all awesome, and I was trying them out for the last few weeks. I was changing the names on them and kind of seeing which ones stuck with their personality, and these were the winners. To merge the flocks together, you can't just mix them all up, because there is a thing of the pecking order, and the older chickens, who have the OGs who have been around, will pick fights with the younger chickens. We do have the two coops. The older chickens are in one coop, the babies are in another, and we have them near each other. We've been putting them closer and closer together, and we have two separate fenced-in areas where when the chickens all come outside of their coop, they're in a fenced-in area, but they can see each other. So the fenced-in areas are right beside each other. It's literally two fenced-in areas beside each other. It's kind of inefficient, but that is how, from what we understand, we've never done this before, you slowly merge the flocks so they can see each other and get used to each other. Now we're at the point where we are letting them out and free-ranging where they can kind of mix, which is good because you want the space. And we have seen that Gallo, the original rooster, really does mind his own business. It's Zorro, the black rooster, the little guy. He is running and picking on Gallo. He'll run and jump on his back and mount him, and then Gallo will turn around, and then Zorro will just take off running. like a little kid, like, "Ha-ha, I attack you, now run away and hide." It's really interesting to watch. The other two little roosters, they don't do much. They don't care. They get along just fine. It's Zorro who's trying to establish dominance. And then Creme Brulee, she, of the original three, she's the bottom rung chicken. She's the one that everybody picks on. She gets treated like poo, unfortunately. We feel really bad for her. She's the one that had all of her feathers missing. We had to get a special apron for her back. She is now picking on some of the baby hens because she does not like being bottom rung chicken, and she's trying to establish dominance over anybody so that way they now become the bottom chicken. And that's what she is trying to do. So she will go over and start picking on hens, and then the three little roosters will come over and start picking on her, and then Guile will come and try to defend her. And this is why you have to introduce the flocks very slowly, because everybody starts fighting. Another disturbing fact: if the chickens do fight and one of them draws blood on another one, the chicken who is bleeding will get attacked by all of the chickens. They will just like turn into little cannibals and start going to town and will end up killing the chicken if you don't remove them to heal up. You have to completely separate them while they heal. That's really messed up, but that's how chickens are, I guess. The only thing that we know going forward is that we're going to need a lot of space, a really big run area. Originally, we were just going to combine the two smaller fences together, but we don't think that's big enough. You need the space that way the chickens have a chance to run away from each other. Because even when Zoro would fight with Gaio and take off running, Gaio didn't really chase him down. Like, you just need space. As long as everybody has their space, they're good. And they can all sleep in one coop. When they go to bed, they just roost and go to sleep. They don't care. But then when they wake up, it's a different bird. And that's when you need lots and lots of space. We did order all of the materials. We got them. They're at the house. We have the materials to build a bigger fence. We just need to do it. Which is easier said than done. The weather is getting cold. We have other things, other outdoor projects that we're trying to wrap up before the cold weather hits. And it's every weekend we have activities planned because we are social, apparently. A few episodes ago, I talked about bringing back the basics: reduce, reuse, recycle. Also other R words like repurpose. And I've talked about repurposing dryer lint as a fire starter or toilet paper rolls as bird feeders. Today, we will talk about a very ghoulish way to repurpose mummified human remains. I'm aware this is very disturbing and unethical. That is why I made it the Halloween episode. We're going to learn about all of the very weird and odd ways that humans in the past repurposed mummies. I give credit to My Favorite Murder podcast, episode 351, because that's where I learned about this and then looked a little bit more into it with a few follow-up articles, including a couple of articles from The Conversation and another one from Medical News Today. Did you know there used to be an abundance of mummies and people do all kinds of weird things with mummies? Shout out to Brendan Fraser. Thank you for making the Mummy trilogy. But prior to that, there used to be a huge fascination with Egypt and mummies. Yes, at one point they were very prevalent and could be found almost everywhere, it seemed. And now they are rare. Let's start in late medieval Europe, where they're trying out some wild remedies in hopes of curing ailments and calling it medicine. In the 12th century, Europeans were in North Africa for the Crusades, and they learned about, I think it's pronounced bitumen. Bitumen. It's B-I-T-U-M-E-N. Bitumen. Which is basically a solid crude oil derived from coal tar and mineral pitch. But more importantly, its medicinal properties. Mummified remains were covered in the embalming substance, bitumen. Ancient Egyptians used a substance called mamia as an embalming agent. Mamia is Persian for wax, and that is where mummy comes from. The mamia takes on a black waxy appearance as it ages and looks like bitumen. Unfortunately, due to limited scientific tests and access to the internet to look things up, the Europeans think the mummies are covered in bitumen. Now, it is a little controversial. That's what I was trying to look up amongst different articles and figure out. It's not really clear when or how, but the ancient Egyptians did mummify both with bitumen and mamia. Some articles say that bitumen is a form of mamia. Some articles say that bitumen was the embalming and the mamia was the wax. So it's a little bit confusing, but they did end up using both of them at some point. So the Europeans weren't wrong, but they weren't right either. Since the Europeans think this is what they need, they begin raiding Egyptian tombs to bring the intact remains back to Europe. Insert your historical Lara Croft Tomb Raider right here. That's what it makes me think of. I would like to add in, stealing ancient human remains is wrong, but back then, they were not as progressive in their thinking. Physicians and apothecaries, which is what we call pharmacists today, they would scrape the mumia from the mummies, which is that wax outer coating. They would scrape it from the mummies and grind it into a powder and combine it with honey or oil to create tinctures and elixirs. Now, elixir is a really fun word to say, and it makes me think of Merlin and wizardry. Growing up, we had a board game called Elixir, and I messaged my mom and asked, do we still have this down in the basement? And we do. And when you go online to look it up, they don't make it anymore, so it's worth like $75 to $150 for any collectors. Are we going to sell it? No. We're actually all going to get together and play it, and I'm really excited about that. Anyways, the tinctures and elixirs would cure everything, all sorts of ailments, ranging from headaches, swelling, abscesses, fractures, wounds, coughs, you name it, it was a cure-all. Always question anything that is advertised as a cure-all. It could be borderline cannibalism, because ingesting ground-up mummy, I think, counts. I'm also pretty sure this would make you sick as heck. There is no scientific evidence backing up these claims as a cure-all. That's a giant red flag all over the place. Another odd fact, corpse medicine, which is what they called it, that was normal in the Middle Ages. Yeah, that's disturbing. In ancient times, Romans would drink the blood from dead gladiators to treat things like epilepsy. And in ancient India, formerly known as Mesopotamia, people believed the body parts and organs of the dead were powerful healing agents when you ate them. Yuck. By the standards of the rest of the world, consuming mummy medicine was completely acceptable. Listen, just because your friend jumps off a cliff doesn't mean that you need to follow suit. Same goes for consuming human remains. Now at the time, the public was led to believe the mummy medicine came from Egyptian royalty, which only makes it more exotic and reason to make it more expensive. Now, this was false. They were led to believe this. Even though the wax used on the human remains was called mumia, people started to refer to the whole intact remains as mumia, and then eventually started just calling the whole unit mummies. This made it easy to jump from the wax mumia providing medicinal properties to believing consumption of any part of the mummy would have health benefits. Physicians would grind up the mummies, including skulls, bones, and dried flesh, and make health tonics, elixirs, etc. for the next 500 years. That is a very long time. People also started to buy into the idea that ingesting the mumia would provide them with spiritual energy, healing, knowledge, and wisdom. Because somehow, all of the ancient Egyptian knowledge and wisdom will just transfer from the ground up body parts right into your gut. That's sarcasm, by the way. Ironically, in the medieval period, the era we are talking about, cannibalism was considered repulsive by Europeans. It was only something that happened during a famine or in non-civilized culture. It was viewed as a primitive and barbaric practice. In my opinion, ingesting mumia totally counts as cannibalism. But hey, if it's a cure-all, then it's totally justified. In 1564, a physician to the royal family traveled to Europe to see what was happening with the mumia craze. He was skeptical about it and questioned the ethics and efficacy. Thank goodness. Just like the law of supply and demand, an increasing demand in Europe resulted in short supply of royal mummies. Further hampering the supply, the Egyptian government put a stop to exporting remains around the same time. And due to the stopping of tomb raiding, Egyptian exporters resort to forging mummies, like making fake ones. I knew that you could forge a document or forge a sword, but I did not know that you could forge a mummy. Turns out it's rather simple. The exporters would substitute unclaimed remains of dead peasants, slaves, and executed criminals. They would mimic the mummying process by filling the bodies with bitumen, bandage them, and lay them in the sun to dry out. The buyers, or traffickers really, in Europe, didn't know about the fake mummies. The demand for corpse medicine had grown so high, it eventually led to grave robbing. Mummia was prescribed as a popular cure-all all the way into the 18th century. It does eventually fall out of favor because more and more doctors are starting to speak up against the ethics of it. Thank goodness. Even though consuming mummia falls to the wayside, demands for mummified remains continue in Europe for a different purpose. Got any guesses? Did you guess for creating a special rich brown paint used by Renaissance artists? Wow, that's correct! They would take the powdered human or feline mummified remains and create a rich, warm brown pigment. This color becomes known as mummy brown. This was manufactured and sold. The good news, is that mummy remains go a long way in creating this paint. One mummy would create a 20-year supply for one artist. It's a little translucent paint and would be used in watercolor for creating shading and shadow effects. Also, it was ideal for skin-colored tones. Eventually, other browns became more favorable in the art scene and artists stopped using it. In the 20th century, it is no longer available from paint supplies. There is one story where, in the 19th century, an English artist named Edward Burne Jones was so horrified when he discovered the truth behind the mummy brown paint that he buried his last tube of the paint in his garden in an effort to restore respect to the remains. That was really nice of him. Unfortunately, it's unknown which famous pieces of art from this period contain the mummy brown paint, but it was widely used and there's definitely a strong chance of it being in multiple art pieces. If you are an art collector and have encountered hauntings in your home where a piece of art containing mummy brown is hung, that may be why you are being haunted. 1964 was when it was announced there were no longer supplies to make the color mummy brown. To recap, by the 18th and 19th century, the use of mummia as medicine is declining. Painting with mummified remains is still common, right in this time frame. And there is a growing exotic appeal of mummies. Egyptomania. Yes, that's a word. It makes me think of WrestleMania, but this is all about Egypt, I guess. It's craze over Egypt, and it takes over Western Europe. This is heavily influenced by the European colonization of North Africa. Napoleon went on his first expedition to Egypt in 1798. This made it possible for wealthy Europeans to buy artifacts and take them home as collector's items. This included intact mummies from artifact dealers or traders on the street. When mummies make it to the homes of the wealthy, they are used for a very disturbing purpose. Unwrapping parties! Makes me think it was kind of like the original unboxing videos that are so popular on YouTube now. This is a fully intact mummy in a case. This is a dead body. They invite all of their friends over, and I'm sure there's drinking and fancy champagne and caviar and other gross rich people foods, and they have an unwrapping party. In 1834, a renowned surgeon named Thomas Pettigrew held the earliest known mummy unwrapping event at the Royal College of Surgeons. This guy was a big deal. He went on to become the founding treasurer of the British Archaeological Society. This is the era of public surgeries and autopsies. The general public would come and watch them, so a mummy unwrapping event wasn't too far off, I guess, in taste. And Pettigrew's events would draw up to 3,000 people. So he would buy a mummy, host an unboxing event in the name of science, and charge people admission and make a ton of money doing that. Now, this unwrapping event started off focusing on the science and then was adopted by rich people as a party trick. These gatherings would be held in private homes and even theaters where they would sell out. Some would still take place in educational institutions to give it an appearance of respectability and scientific curiosity. What would happen at an unwrapping party? Attendants would clap and cheer as the mummy is unwrapped layer by layer. At these events, some things would not go as anticipated. In one unwrapping, the bandages hadn't fused with the body. In another, the mummy's head was full of sand. And there was a public reveal of a reported mummy princess who turned out to be a man. By the end of these parties, the mummies were desecrated and damaged beyond repair, all for the sake of entertainment. Mummy unwrapping parties became huge events, and of course the demand for mummies skyrocketed. This led to a mummy shortage, and again, mummy forgeries were used. By the turn of the century, unwrapping parties declined in popularity. Thank goodness. The reveal and shock value are no longer there. At the same time, society is starting to realize we need to respect the dead and preserve the ancient remains of other cultures. Fortunately, the unwrapping parties trend does end, and remains that are left in Britain do go to museums, but some remains are too damaged and are sold off to paint manufacturers to make mummy brown, because that is still happening during this time period. And if they were not sold to paint manufacturers, sometimes they were ground up and used as fertilizer. Luckily, using mummia as a medical treatment, painting with mummy brown, and unwrapping parties are all a thing of the past. However, we are still fascinated and respectful with mummies in modern times. Museums now adhere to strict ethical guidelines to ensure mummified remains are respected and not exploited. Also, where possible, mummy remains were returned to their country of origin. There is your very gruesome and oddly sustainable way of repurposing mummy remains. I do want everyone to repurpose items and get multiple uses out of them. However, there is a line, and it was significantly crossed at reusing, repurposing mummy remains. So don't do that. It is time for your challenge. I want you to reuse or repurpose an item, not a human remain, just an item, and incorporate it into your Halloween costume somehow. You still have time. You can pull this off. You've got almost all week. You can totally do this. Come up with something. Clearly not a 2-liter Coke bottle, because those are very hard to come by, but something else. Let's see how creative you are, and then share it on the Starting Sustainability Facebook group. The next episode will be on November 6th, and the topic is undecided at this moment in time. Sorry to leave you hanging. Until then, have a happy Halloween, stay spooky, and continue saving the world. I'll see you on November 6th. Have a great one. Bye.